Chapter 17. Petronius to Vinicius. Thy case is a bad one, Carissim. It is clear that Venus has disturbed thy mind, deprived thee of reason and memory, as well as the power to think of aught else except love. Read some time thy answer to my letter, and thou wilt see how indifferent thy mind is to all except Lygia, how exclusively it is occupied with her, how it returns to her always, and circles above her, as a falcon above chosen prey. By Pollux, find her quickly, or that of thee which fire has not turned into ashes will become an Egyptian sphinx, which, enamored, as 'tis said, of pale Isis, grew deaf and indifferent to all things, waiting only for night, so as to gaze with stony eyes at the loved one. Run disguised through the city in the evening, even on her Christian houses of prayer in thy philosopher's company. Whatever excites hope and kills time is praiseworthy. But for my friendship's sake do this one thing. Ursus, Lygia's slave, is a man of uncommon strength very likely. Hire Croton, and go out three together, that will be safer and wiser. The Christians, since Pomponia and Lygia belong to them, are surely not such scoundrels as most people imagine. But when the lamb of their flock is in question they are no triflers, as they have shown by carrying away Lygia. When thou seest Lygia thou wilt not restrain thyself, I am sure, and wilt try to bear her away on the spot. But how wilt thou and Chilonites do it? Croton would take care of himself, even though 10 like Ursus defended the maiden. Be not plundered by Chio, but be not sparing of money on Croton. Of all counsels which I can give this is the best one. Here they have ceased to speak of the infant Augusta, or to say that she perished through witchcraft. Poppaea mentions her at times yet, but Caesar's mind is stuffed with something else. Moreover, if it be true that the divine Augusta is in a changed state again, the memory of that child will be blown away without trace. We have been in Naples for some days, or rather in Bale. If thou art capable of any thought, echoes of our life must strike thy ear, for surely Rome talks of naught else. We went directly to Bai Tilda, where at first memories of the mother attacked us, and reproaches of conscience. But dost thou know to what Ahenobarbus has gone already? To this, that for him even the murder of his mother is a mere theme for verses, and a reason for buffoonish tragic scenes. Formerly he felt real reproaches only in so far as he was a coward. Now, when he is convinced that the earth is under his feet as before, and that no god is taking vengeance, he feigns them only to move people by his fate. He springs up at night sometimes declaring that the Furies are hunting him. He rouses us, looks around, assumes the posture of an actor playing the role of Orestes, and the posture of a bad actor too. He declaims Greek verses, and looks to see if we are admiring him. We admire him apparently, and instead of saying to him, "Go to sleep, thou buffoon," we bring ourselves also to the tone of tragedy, and protect the great artist from the Furies. By Castor, this news at least must have reached thee, that he has appeared in public at Naples. They drove in from the city, and the surrounding towns all the Greek ruffians, who filled the arena with such a vile odor of sweat and garlic, that I thank the gods that, instead of sitting in the first rows with the Augustians, I was behind the scenes with Ahenobarbus. And wilt thou believe it, he was afraid really. He took my hand and put it to his heart, which was beating with increased pulsation. His breath was short, and at the moment when he had to appear he grew as pale as a parchment, and his forehead was covered with drops of sweat. Still he saw that in every row of seats were praetorians, armed with clubs, to rouse enthusiasm, if the need came. But there was no need. No herd of monkeys from the environs of Carthage could howl as did this rabble. I tell thee that the smell of garlic came to the stage, but Nero bowed, pressed his hand to his heart, sent kisses from his lips, and shed tears. Then he rushed in among us, who were waiting behind the scenes, like a drunken man, crying, "What were the triumphs of Julius compared with this triumph of mine?" But the rabble was howling in and applauding, knowing that it would applaud to itself favors, gifts, banquets, lottery tickets, and a fresh exhibition by the imperial buffoon. I do not wonder that they applauded, for such a sight had not been seen till that evening. And every moment he repeated, "See what the Greeks are, see what the Greeks are." From that evening it has seemed to me that his hatred for Rome is increasing. Meanwhile, special couriers were hurried to Rome announcing the triumph, and we expect thanks from the Senate one of these days. Immediately after Nero's first exhibition, a strange event happened here. The theater fell in on a sudden, but just after the audience had gone. I was there, and did not see even one corpse taken from the ruins. Many, even among the Greeks, see in this event the anger of the gods, because the dignity of Caesar was disgraced. He, on the contrary, finds in it favor of the gods, who of his song, and those who listen to it, under their evident protection. Hence there are offerings in all the temples, and great thanks. For Nero it is a great encouragement to make the journey to a few days, since he told me, however, that he had doubts as to what the Roman people might say, that they might revolt out of love for him, and fear touching the distribution of grain and touching the games, which might fail him in case of his prolonged absence. We are going, however, to Beneventum to look at the cobbler magnificence which Vatinius will exhibit, and thence to Greece, under the protection of the divine brothers of Helen. As to me, I have noted one thing, that when a man is amped the mad he grows mad himself, and, what is more, finds a certain charm in mad pranks. Greece and the journey in 1,000 ships, a kind of triumphal advance of Bacchus among nymphs and bacchants crowned with myrtle, vine, and honeysuckle. There will be women in tiger skins harnessed to chariots, flowers, thyrses, garlands, shouts of Evo, music, poetry, and applauding Hellas. All this is well, but we cherish besides more daring projects. We wish to create a species of Oriental Imperium, an empire of palm trees, sunshine, poetry, and reality turned into a dream, reality turned into the delight of life only. We want to forget Rome, to fix the balancing point of the world somewhere between Greece, Asia, and Egypt, to live the life, not of men but of gods, not to know what commonness is, to wander in golden galleys under the shadow of purple sails along the archipelago, to be Apollo, Osseus, and Baal in one person, to be rosy with the dawn, golden with the sun, silver with the moon, to command, to sing, to dream. And wilt thou believe that I, who have still sound judgment to the value of a sestertium, and sense to the value of an ass, let myself be borne away by these fantasies, and I do this for the reason that, if they are not possible, they are at least grandiose and uncommon? Such a fabulous empire would be a thing which, some time or other, after long ages, would seem a dream to mankind. Except when Venus takes the form of Lygia, or even of a slave Eunice, or when art beautifies it, life itself is empty, and many a time it has the face of a monkey. But Bronzebeard will not realize his plans, even for this cause, that in his fabulous kingdom of poetry and the Orient no place is given to treason, meanness, and death, and that in him with the poses of a poet sits a wretched comedian, a dull charioteer, and a frivolous tyrant. Meanwhile we are killing people whenever they displease us in any way. Poor Torquatus Silanus is now a shade. He opened his veins a few days since. Lucanius and Licinus will enter on the consulate with terror. Old Thrasea will not escape death, for he dares to be honest. Tigellinus is not able yet to frame a command for me to open my veins. I am still needed, not only as elegante arbiter, but as a man without whose counsel and taste the expedition to Achaea might fail. More than once, however, I think that sooner or later it must end in opening my veins, and knowest thou what the question will be then with me? That Bronzebeard should not get my goblet, which thou knowest and admirest. Shouldst thou be near at the moment of my death, I will give it to thee, Shouldst thou be at a distance, I will break it. But meanwhile I have before me, yet Beneventum of the cobblers and Olympian Greece, I have fate too, which, unknown and unforeseen, points out the road to everyone. Be well, and engage Croton, otherwise they will snatch Lydia from thee a second time. When Chionite ceases to be needful, send him to me wherever I may be. Perhaps I shall make him a second Vatinius, and consuls and senators may tremble before him yet, as they trembled before that night Dratevka. It would be worth while to live to see such a spectacle. When thou hast found Lydia, let me know, so that I may offer for you both a pair of swans, and a pair of doves in the round temple of Venus here. Once I saw Lydia in a dream, sitting on thy knee, seeking thy kisses. Try to make that dream prophetic. May there be no clouds on thy sky, or if there be, let them have the color and the odor of roses. Be in good health, and farewell. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.